Well, hello, greetings, and welcome. Welcome to another edition of The Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel. Coming up in the interview segment of the program, Sid Bolton will be joining us. He is a computer collector and video game collector and computer game collector. He is just really an extraordinary individual, really interesting to talk to, and you'll hear yourselves what a good guest and fun guy to talk to he is. What really got me on to the idea of doing a show on video game collecting was a news item that we had on here several weeks ago, and it was about an effort to go dig up a bunch of old video game cartridges that were manufactured by the Atari company. And Atari took these games based on the movie E.T. and buried them in the desert, literally. Buried unsold copies in the desert. It's like the new Coke of video games, or if you're a little older, the Edsel Ford of video games. Likely the worst video game ever. But that's what got me on to wanting to do a program about video game collecting. And what you'll hear from Sid is that it's really a neat hobby and more interest in it than you might think. He has a whole museum devoted to his computer equipment collection, so more to come with Sid here in the interview segment. Of course, as always, news from the world of collecting. There is a Babe Ruth memorabilia auction that's being held by a company called Golden, and it's G-O-L-D-I-N, Golden Auctions. They have a couple of hundred items from Babe Ruth that they're going to be auctioning, and some will be selling for over $100,000, but I thought I'd share with you baseball collector folks some of the things that were going to be sold. A 1918 Babe Ruth Boston Red Sox contract. It's his own copy, and it's the earliest existing Ruth player contract that's known, and it will start the bidding at $250,000. That's a lot. A 1914 Baltimore News Babe Ruth graded PSA 1, and this is considered to be the real or genuine Babe Ruth rookie baseball card, and the bidding on that starts at a mere $100,000. And let's see, what else? 1916 to 1918 rookie era Babe Ruth game used Hillerick and Bradsby bats, and those will start at $50,000. That's quite a lot of money, but if you've got it and you're a big fan of Babe Ruth, why not? It's Golden, G-O-L-D-I-N, and you can participate if you want to online. There's another story from Kiplinger's. They publish newsletters and web materials about personal finance, and they talk about the value of some collectibles compared to the S&P. According to Kiplinger's, many collectibles have seen run-ups in value that could make you think you're missing out, but maybe not. For example, they say that over the last 10 years, collectible cars appreciated 450%. They also say that fine art value went up another 200%. The S&P, or as it's better known, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, a measly 111%. So if you're a savvy investor, you can make a lot of money in collectibles, and I'm happy that the people at Kiplinger's point this out. If you're going to make money in collectibles, you got to know what you're doing. You have to have knowledge and skill. You have to be able to choose wisely. You have to ride out fads. And you generally, and this is true of stocks and bonds as well, have to hold on to your purchase for several years before it appreciates, if ever. And that's going to tie up your cash, which you could be putting into other things like, advertising on the collector's show. But if you're going to realize a profit, you have to eventually sell. And as we know, as devoted collectors, a lot of us aren't interested in selling our collections. So if you're interested in reading more, you can go to the Kiplinger's website and read their article about making money on collectibles. And they cite different types of things. They talk about cars and wine. It's pretty involved, pretty good article. I recommend it. Now, we've talked before on the program about estate planning and wills with respect to collectibles, but did you know that you also are going to have to bequeath your virtual assets, like your email address, your Twitter handle, your Facebook account? All of those kinds of things are going to have to be willed, or they just disappear out into the ether. Your PayPal account, your Bitcoin accounts, if you have one, iTunes, the website domains that you own, your email accounts, all of those need to be part of your estate planning. So what most folks do with their virtual assets is they keep a list of, say, URLs that you own on an Excel sheet and put it as part of your personal papers, or if you have one, a lawyer or a will executor, and they will make sure that your websites and your Facebook account go to the people that you want them to go to or are just taken down. And I know I have had friends who passed away who had Facebook accounts. And if you ever looked at your friends on Facebook and you saw a friend or a relative who'd passed away, but they still had a Facebook account up, that was unsettling for a lot of us. And then the worst one I ever saw was I had a friend who had passed away, and I got a notice that it was his birthday. Eep. So make arrangements for those kinds of things. So at best, the people you want to have them will receive them, and you won't creep out your friends who are left behind. Okay. That's it for the news. You can check out the rest on Collector's Show website, which is collectorsshow.net. Meanwhile, when we come back, it's Sid Bolton and his incredible video game collection here on the Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel. Our guest this week on the Collector's Show is Sid Bolton. Sid is a very big collector of all things computer and video game, and according to the Canadian Broadcast Company, he has the largest collection of video games in Canada, and I'm willing to bet probably anywhere in the world, owning, according to his website, nearly 15,000 separate games. He is an accomplished author and recognized expert in his field, and Sid, welcome to the Collector's Show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for making time for us. And I want us to talk a lot about your collection today. But first, I wanted to ask you about something that I saw online. This is about a very old video game that was based on the movie E.T. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was it's very famous in video game lore. That was the Atari, specifically the Atari 2600 version of E.T. And it was a game that was developed in a very, very short time schedule. And so because of that, I had a lot of problems. But it wasn't just that sort of made it famous, of course. It's one of those things that's over time people have chosen to talk about. A lot of people have blamed the video game crash of 1983 on this game. There was a lot of mistakes made during the development. There was a lot of mistakes made during the marketing of this game. And so it's sort of taken on a life of its own. And of course, most recently, you may have heard in the news that a group of people went out to the desert in New Mexico and actually looked for extra copies of this game that were reportedly buried in the desert.
It was such a bad game that it was given a funeral, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, buried in the desert, covered up with cement. And I guess the folks who buried it hoped it would be forgotten forever, but not so, right?
Well, part of it was, from my understanding, part of it is actually something that Atari had decided to do in terms of destroying the games for financial reasons, because actually in order to sort of write these games off the books, they had to destroy them. They weren't selling. Atari reportedly actually ordered more copies of the game to be made than they had systems to go with it at the time.
Oh,
because their thinking was that this game was going to be so big. You know, if you think back to 1982 when this all happened, of course, the E.T. movie was a huge hit with moviegoers. It was the blockbuster of the year, and Steven Spielberg was, you know, sort of the hot director of the time. And so they just thought that they were going to sell a copy of this game to everybody that bought a system, and that not only that, but that, you know, people that didn't own the Atari system were going to buy one in order to pick up a copy of this game. And what ended up happening was, and it's not, you know, I have to be honest, the game isn't as bad as a lot of people report that it is. It is a little confusing. A lot of people that played it weren't quite sure what to do in the game, and that resulted in a lot of returns. A lot of kids, you know, remember, kids are playing this, you know.
Right.
If an adult was playing the game, they could probably figure it out and probably figure out what was going on, but a lot of times the kids were getting confused, so they would get upset. And of course, the parents had spent a lot of money on these games, and so they were taking them back to the retailer and saying, you know, this game is way too confusing for my kid. I want my money back. And it was also a time where a lot of other companies were starting to dump sort of junk games on the market as well. And so it wasn't just E.T., but a lot of other third-party games were coming out. You have to remember that there wasn't any licensing of video games back then like there is today. And so there was absolutely no control over the games that were coming into the market. So a lot of people were trying to do a cash grab and building off the success of this particular platform. And so it wasn't just E.T. Lots of bad games came into the market, and I think parents were just getting frustrated at spending so much money on these games and then getting them home and finding out they were just terrible. So they were just saying, you know what, we're going to take a stand. We're just going to take these back and ask for our money back. And that's what sort of led to the downfall, partially anyways, of the video game crash of 1983.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating story all by itself. So the things that I've read said not just that the game was so terrible and led to this crash, but really helped take down Atari as a game console manufacturer supplier. But other than it being confusing, and I had a game for my Intellivision back about the same time that was called Dungeons and Dragons that had absolutely nothing to do with the board game, role-playing game, Dungeons and Dragons, where characters would get stuck in holes and you couldn't get them out. And it was the same kind of thing with this E.T. game. Isn't that right?
Yeah, you basically had to collect different pieces of the telephone. I mean, to his credit, Howard Scott Warshaw, the developer of the game, he actually did try to make the game mimic the story of the movie somewhat. You had to collect pieces of the phone so that E.T. could put it together and essentially phone home and request that the spaceship come and get him. Because that's sort of, as we know, the whole premise, the movie, spoiler for anyone who missed the 1982 movie E.T. Hopefully you haven't, but if you did, that's a bit of a spoiler there.
Right.
But another thing that's interesting in video game lore, and it's a story that involved me personally, was that a couple of years ago, we actually, so in addition to being a video game collector, you mentioned at the beginning that I'm also interested in computers. Well, I actually have a computer museum in Canada. And we had received a copy of a game that was called Extraterrestrials. It had just the name Extraterrestrials. It wasn't E.T., but the actual word Extraterrestrials. And it was developed for the Atari about a year after the official E.T. game came out. And interestingly enough, because the market had crashed, by the time this game was ready for prime time, only about, we estimate about 200 copies of this game were ever sold, and they were all sold in the Canadian market. And so the game had been essentially lost, other than a handful of them that are still out there with people that bought it way back in the day. And because it was sort of limited to a very small geographical location in Canada, the Atari market, the community, which is a very active community still today, by the way, I should add, had no idea that this game had ever come out. It was the only Canadian-developed video game for the Atari system from the time. And we actually brought it back to life, but its whole premise and the whole reason existed that it existed was, you know, mostly because of the success of the Atari and the fact that E.T. was also a big movie. So again, people at the time were like, video games are making money, movies are making money, you know, because it wasn't a given that blockbusters were out. I mean, until Jaws and Star Wars in the late 70s, we didn't really have movies that made the kind of money that movies make today.
Right.
And so with all these things suddenly, you know, happening, people were like trying to make money off of this. And so this is exactly what happened. There was some, you know, some guys up here in Canada said, hey, we could do this. And they hired a programmer that reverse engineered the Atari. They had a guy that had some money and he had some manufacturing experience. So, he actually made the cartridge shells and everything. And these guys, you know, spent a lot of money trying to figure out and make this game, and it ultimately flopped. And so we've actually, you know, revived this game. We've made it available for free for people to download and try. And we also have a reproduction cartridge that people can buy if they actually want to play a physical copy of the game. So it was kind of interesting because, of course, when we were researching this, the whole thing about the E.T. game came up and people were saying, well, this kind of looks like E.T. Is this, you know, is this the really bad E.T. cartridge? And we're like, no, no, it's not. It's, although it has an E.T.-like character in it, it has the name Extraterrestrials. It has nothing to do with that game other than the fact that it was inspired by it. And coincidentally, you know, of course, it ended up having the same fate in essence. You know, it was a failure, a commercial failure.
Right.
And, you know, it just ended up causing a whole lot of trauma in the video
right.
game world. So, but it makes for interesting storytelling, you know, many, many years later.
Well, now that as a collectible, I mean, I sort of get that it's a counterfeit of the Atari game, and there were only a couple of hundred of them made. So as collectibles go, that kind of makes sense. But if you're going to, as you said, they wanted to destroy the games, well, then why not just, you know, have a big fire? Or, you know, why bury them in New Mexico?
The choices that were made, as far as I know, because there is one other story, a big story about a dumping of electronic stuff that isn't told very often, I don't think. And this has to do with Commodore. I don't know if you remember the Commodore 64.
I owned stock in Commodore.
Well, there you go.
It's the worst investment ever.
Well, one of the things you may not have known as an investor was that after the Commodore 64, everyone knows how successful the 64 was, Commodore produced a follow-up called the Commodore 16 and the Commodore Plus 4. So the 16 was intended to replace the low-end market with the VIC-20, and the Commodore Plus 4 was intended to be the next generation of the Commodore 64. Unfortunately, it had little to do with its predecessor, and you know, it was a different machine completely. It wasn't as capable in some ways, but it was more capable in other ways. Overall, complete disaster. Wasn't compatible with the joysticks that came from the previous model, anything. So, I mean, if you bought one of these things, you were kind of isolated in a separate island. Commodore thought it was a wise idea because, you know, oh, we'll sell them new joysticks. We'll sell them new disk drives. We'll sell them new this and that, whatever. That's not what people wanted.
Yeah,
and
just being mad.
Yeah, exactly. So these machines became a big failure. And so Commodore actually, again, and this is how I got to know someone at Commodore. This is why I sort of know what happened with this and why I understand a little bit better what Atari did. The company couldn't just write off the inventory they couldn't sell. They had to destroy it. And for Commodore, what they ended up doing with the Commodore 16 and the Commodore Plus 4 is they dumped them in the ocean.
Oh, wow.
And so, of course, today, by today's standards, anything like that would, for the environment, would be
never do.
Very, very bad.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they got away with it back then. And in the case of Atari, you know, burning the cartridges, of course, these things, they were made of plastics that were not even recyclable. That's another thing that happens with cartridges today. I mean, even if people had a bunch of Atari cartridges, unfortunately, without knowing exactly what's in that plastic, which they didn't know, recycling is not possible. So, at least in the traditional sense. So, therefore, they felt the best, most environmentally responsible thing to do was bury them. And even back in the day, you know, stories got out locally about these cartridges being buried in the desert. And so kids would run out in the middle of the night and try to get into the dump site and steal the games. And some of them were successful, so much so that Atari then talked to the landfill and said, you know, we need to put concrete on top of this stuff so that kids don't try and get out and try to get the games. And so that's why there was concrete buried on top of the games, was to keep the I don't know if you want to call them grave robbers, but essentially kids were going in and you know, it was dangerous. It's a, you know, it's not exactly a place they should be playing. It's not there's no slides or anything like that there. No. So they need to stay away from that stuff. And so that's why they put concrete on top, which made it a little more difficult to recover those cartridges recently, as they have done.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting all by itself, because my head immediately goes to New Mexico and Roswell and a game about extraterrestrials, and I'm thinking that's a conspiracy, and maybe that's a good rumor for me to start. But other than that particular instance of that really, really bad game, or games that are sort of infamous because they're so poorly designed, what makes a video game collectible?
Well, I think there's two aspects, or at least two aspects. I mean, one is any game that's been developed that has a certain amount of rarity to it is going to likely become collectible, although not every rare game does become collectible or does become expensive. And this is often a perfect example of this is the Chase the Chuck Wagon video game for the Atari. So just quickly, for those that don't know the story, there was a cartridge that was available from Ralston Purina, the dog food company, and it was only available if you sent in proofs of purchases from the dog food to get this game. So you couldn't buy this at retail. Now, you know, when video game collecting first sort of started to be a thing, which I would say was in the 90s, where people starting to, about 20 years after the Atari stuff was sort of started, that was once considered to be the holy grail of collecting.
Chase the Chuck Wagon.
Chase the Chuck Wagon, And so the thing about that game is that it is fairly rare, but there are many games that had lower production runs because, of course, they were advertising this on television. So, of course, in order to meet demand, they made quite a few cartridges. So it's not as rare as you might think. But because of the story behind it and because of, you know, the sort of the people that were discussing it, it became highly collectible, and it still is today. But it certainly has fallen in price as it's been discovered that there's a lot more of these things out there than people have realized. So the first thing, you know, it's sort of like, you know, how rare is it? That has, something to do with the collectability. Secondly, a lot of times when games are rarer and smaller production runs and they're good games, that also means that, you know, in some ways that becomes collectible. Now, that's certainly not the case with E.T. I think E.T., no one has ever really considered the E.T. game to be valuable in the sense of, you know, there's lots of them still out there in the market. But the whole fact that, you know, the story's recently been brought up about it,
right,
and people want to talk about it and they want to talk about the story, that makes it more collectible because there's a good story behind it. So having a good story is one thing. Having a game that's a good game and is harder to obtain makes it more collectible. And then I think those are probably the two big things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's some other things. Like there's always, but they're always branches of one or the other, right? There's always either there's some offshoot of a story for a game and why, you know, there's something interesting that happened in the development, or there's, you know, just something like that. Or a lot of times the low production run becomes a factor. You know, a good example of that is something like Earthbound for the Super Nintendo.
Oh, I love that game.
The game was released late in the cycle of the system. So that means that, you know, because the system was winding down and the replacement system was on the way, a lot of people were not buying games for it anymore. So the games were made with, you know, less copies in the market. And a loose copy of the game is one thing, but if you can get it with the original box, it also had an odd-shaped box because it came with, you know, a sticker book and all this other kind of stuff inside. And so because of that, and because, you know, it took up more space at the retail spot, there was less numbers, there was less copies of it made. So if, you know, you find it loose, that's one thing. But if you find it with everything in it, it's worth a heck of a lot more. And
like
so that's
how
another
much?
Example.
How much would Earthbound go for?
You could probably look to spend between $300 to $600 for a copy of Earthbound today.
Get out of here. I played that game back in the 90s. I loved that game. I went looking for the Earthbound 2, and it only was introduced in Japan. And I know that we gave it away. Oh, man.
Yeah, and that's another thing, too. A lot of times, a lot of these game series come from other countries, and sometimes, you know, a copy of the game that's available in another language is easier to find, and lower production runs are done over here in North America. Sometimes games get reprinted and their value goes down. You know, a perfect example of that on the PlayStation 2, there was a game called Guitaru Man, not Guitar, but Guitaru, G-I-T. And this is before the whole Guitar Hero thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the game was very niche, very unusual, very Japanese. Had one print copy done, you know, that was it. And you could tell that it was the original print run because it would have, Sony had the certain type of labeling they would do on the top of the game. But of course, once the game was open, that sort of sticker would be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And after a period of time, people realized that, you know, actually this is kind of a cool game, and people started requesting it, and the price for the game went up and up and up until, you know, copies of it were like $150, $200 or so, especially new, you know, they would really be worth a lot of money. And so there's actually a couple of companies that buy up rights to video games that have sort of expired, their time has gone from the main publisher. The main publisher isn't interested in risking any more funds on the game. So they buy a license, you know, hey, can we make, you know, 5,000 more copies of this game? We'll give you, you know, $2 a game to license it. So, you know, here's a check for $10,000. Most publishers will say, sure, we don't care anymore.
Yeah.
They'll take their $10,000, and then this smaller company will go out and try to peddle, you know, this 5,000 copies at whatever dollar amount and make some extra cash. And if they make 20,000 or 25,000, that's okay. If they do it, you know, with a whole bunch of games, that's enough money to keep them afloat.
Boy, isn't
it? And so, yeah, but then the market gets flooded again. You know, all of a sudden there's now 5,000 more copies of this game, and they're legitimate. I mean, they're right. Licensed, whatever, but they're, what happened, at least in the Sony marketplace specifically, is that, you know, the labeling and the stickers on the top were not the same. And so these are like sort of the second generation version of the game. Even the code was identical, the packaging was otherwise identical. And so suddenly the market now has an extra 5,000 copies of these things. And now the value of all the other ones has gone down.
Yeah.
And this happens quite a bit in the video game world, or anything that's, you know, has a reproduction possibility. You know, video games particularly are pretty easy to reproduce, as are any other sort of digital art form, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
So as a collector, that's one red flag you have to watch out for, is it possible for anyone to reproduce this game and cause the value to go down? It's less likely to happen with cartridge-based games, but it's quite possible to happen with electronic games. But even today, something like Earthbound, the price has gone down a little bit because recently Nintendo decided to release Earthbound digitally so you can download it. So suddenly all these people that have a thirst, or, you know, want to, you know, this hunger to go out and play Earthbound, say, such as yourself.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, you, if you go and look on, you know, an auction site and see, wow, it's like several hundred dollars to buy it, you're going to be turned off. But if I said to you, hey, you can go to Nintendo's, you know, eStore and buy it for $10, suddenly, you know, your thirst is gone.
Yeah.
Because you could actually play it, unless you're really, really keen on having a physical copy. Now, collectors like me got to have the physical copy.
Absolutely.
But your average person just wants to play.
Well, and now I know what I'm doing tonight. I'm playing Earthbound.
There you go.
There was another platform from Nintendo, and I think it was in the 90s, that was kind of their attempt at a virtual reality. I can't remember what it was called, but it was
a huge flop, yes? It was. You know, Nintendo doesn't make a lot of mistakes in terms of what they release to the market. And, you know, the jury's still out on the Wii U right now, for example. But certainly with the Virtual Boy, you know, it was really, you know, ended up only having a little over a dozen titles available for it. And it also caused eye strain, especially with young people.
Well, it was
that's
all
never good.
It was all one color. It was all red, wasn't it?
Yes, because at the time, 3D technology was very, very limited, very much in its infancy.
Right.
So, and Nintendo really hasn't given up on 3D. We know with the 3DS that they feel that that's something that gamers want, but they were a little too early to market, I think, with the Virtual Boy.
Yeah,
in fact,
looking back, it was much too early. The technology just wasn't there.
And in fact, the creator of the Virtual Boy ended up sort of getting shunned at Nintendo and ended up leaving. And he actually created the Game Boy. He created the original Game Boy. He created the Nintendo Game & Watch series, which was very popular and very collectible today. Right. And he ended up going to Bandai and creating the WonderSwan, which was, of course, another handheld competitor only available in Japan. So we don't really know too much about it here in North America, unless you're really into video games like I am. But he also released the first color portable system with this WonderSwan, and then tragically he was killed in a car accident.
Oh, that is tragic.
So so his story ends way too early, but his Virtual Boy had some interesting concepts, has a couple of interesting titles, very collectible today because, again, it's got a story, it's got a limited number of them. Now, the value of the system itself has fluctuated greatly over the years because partly there was a, people at one point, were getting rid of them, dumping them because nobody wanted them. I know myself, I bought one at Toys R Us brand new for $20.
Oh, wow.
And then at one point, a brand new one was going for about $500. You know, you could get a lot of money for one if you had kept one like I did, sort of in the box.
That's a nice return.
That's a nice return on your investment as a collector. And however, somebody discovered a warehouse full of them, only a few years ago. And of course, again, anybody that wanted one that couldn't afford one, they were selling, I think, for $200. And so the average price of them went from $500 down to, $200, $250. So
still,
again, still worth money, still worth more than what most people would have paid for it at the time. And because it has a relatively small library of available titles, at least in North America, there's also quite a few available in Japan. But with such a limited number of titles, it's actually not too difficult to get a complete collection. So for collectors out there that want to have complete and strive for complete collections, the Virtual Boy is actually a really good system to collect for because A, it has that interesting story of being one of Nintendo's few failures. B, has a library that most of the games are extremely affordable. There's just a couple that are kind of expensive. And that makes it much easier for a collector to try and obtain a complete.
Now, I also see on your website that you've got tools. You offer tools and different lists for video game collectors. Tell us about those and who could potentially benefit.
Well, for me, one of the mistakes that I've made as a collector is I've decided to collect everything video game related.
Right.
Which is, a good thing and a bad thing. But one of the frustrations that I've experienced is trying to get decent lists in order to figure out, do I have everything for this particular platform? And it's not so difficult with the classic systems because, video games weren't that popular in the 70s and the 80s. They were, obviously, it became popular enough to continue on. But in terms of the number of titles that were made, very limited. There wasn't thousands and thousands of games made. There were hundreds of games at the most made for each of the systems. A little bit easier to maintain. However, when you get into the newer stuff, we're talking about libraries that exceed over 1,000 titles. And one of the great frustrations for a collector is actually finding a complete list or finding an accurate list. Using online sites, and I'm just going to use Wikipedia as an example because it's very popular on the web. Wikipedia is great. I mean, everyone can contribute to it and has lots of great information. However, sometimes it has too much information. So a perfect example would be to try and go online to Wikipedia and look up a list of video games for, let's just use the original Xbox as an example.
Okay.
The lists that are provided on there include all of the North American releases. They include all the European releases, all the Japanese releases, and they also include all of the games that have been canceled. And sometimes they're even missing games. So as a collector, especially if you're in North America, as I am, and I just want to collect North American games, do I go to find a complete list? And also, there's variants, you know, there's special editions, collector's editions, limited editions, whatever you want to call them. And of course, people call them different things as well. So that can get a little confusing. So when I went to find a list, I couldn't find one that was accurate. You know, I would, I spent hours chasing certain games down only to discover that it, well, it was released, but it was only released in North, or in, you know, the PAL format, say in Britain or somewhere else, or maybe it was only released in Japan. Or, you know, you'd go online and you'd find, you know, some of the gaming sites would have a listing for a certain game. They would show the box art. They'd even have a description. They'd have all the information on there. But it would turn out that the game never actually came out. It was canceled at the last minute. Oh. And sometimes games are canceled even after review copies have been given out. So, for example, there's a dinosaur game that was, you know, only available in Japanese originally for the Xbox, but then an English version was made, sent to review companies. I've actually seen a review that was done on television, but the release was canceled before the actual final game hit market. Now, if you're a collector, you might see that and go, oh, well, I guess the game is out. I see people playing it. There's copies of it. It's in English. Well, I'm sorry, but the game never actually came out. Review copies only. So that's pretty frustrating. So I decided to put together lists that were very straightforward. They just list the titles. They list the titles accurately. That's another thing that frustrates me, is that I see tons of spelling mistakes online. I see inconsistencies on things, even things like, you know, the use of the word the, like the, some people put it at the front, some people put it at the back. Sometimes when a video game is based off of a franchise, the franchise gets put in the front. Like, for example, if it's a, you know, something from, you know, Tom Clancy. Is it Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell, or is it Splinter Cell and then in brackets Tom Clancy's? Like, it's very confusing.
Yeah.
So, you know, how people sort titles, everyone has a different way of doing it. So what I try to do is clean up all that stuff, make it consistent, make sure that only titles that are actually available are put together in this list, and then put check, you know, boxes on it so that a collector can either digitally, you know, using, they're just PDF documents, so you can just click on the checkboxes if you have the game. So if you want to be environmentally conscious and not print things, you can have this list where you can check stuff off with your mouse. And if you're old-fashioned like me and you want to take that list with you in your pocket, the lists are intended to be printed. You know, they're small enough that you can get most of the systems on a couple of pieces of paper that you can fold up in your pocket and take with you when you go to a game store. Because as you become a collector and as you become, you know, having these bigger collections, one of the biggest frustrating things to go on is going to a store and buying something you already own.
Yes.
And I have done it so many times. And video games, collecting video games is one of those things where this happens more often than you might think, primarily because the same game could be available on five different formats. So it's very frustrating to walk into a store, see a cover for a game and say, oh, I already have that. I'm not going to bother picking it up, only to discover as you walk out of the store that you don't have it for that particular platform. The reason it seems familiar to you is because you bought it on a different platform, you know, last week or something like that.
Right.
And that would happen to me constantly as well. So that's why I created these lists. They're free for people to download at my website, sidbolton.com. There's a section under there for video games and video game tools. And people can just go there and download these lists and use them as they see fit. I don't want any money for it. I just want to help out my fellow collector, because I know of the frustration that I went through, and I'm just trying to help people. And these lists, and I just recently finished the PlayStation 2 list. That's the big collection I'm going after now. I even contacted Sony and I said, do you guys have a list? And their answer is, well, we kind of have a list, but not exactly, because you have to remember, from their perspective, they have a list of every game they've ever assigned a code to. But a lot of times companies get their code assigned, they pay their fee to have the game listed, and then that never comes out. So they don't actually have a list of everything that's actually been produced and brought to market. They just have a list of everything they've ever issued a code for.
Well, you mentioned like the punctuation and things like that. And it sounds like a small thing, but if you're a serious collector and you want to be careful about making certain that you buy something that is bona fide, that it's not a counterfeit in other types of collecting, having the punctuation done incorrectly is a red flag. It tells you that, well, this is a fake or it's a knockoff or a second. So I think, you know, your advice about with the apostrophe after Tom Clancy's name and things like that are really important, particularly like if you're going to plunk down $600 for Earthbound, you want to make sure it's the real deal.
Exactly. And also, you know, sometimes when you look at titles on a shelf, most retailers, and certainly in the case of video games, will display the games with their spine showing because that's the, you know, takes up the least amount of real estate in a store.
Right.
And so I try to make sure that I put that so that when you're looking for games, that the way it is on the spine is the way it is on the list. Because again, when you have something where the franchise name is at the beginning or the end, you could bypass something and not pick it up because it's not in the right place.
Right.
And you would be surprised how many games actually have that situation. You know, and also things like, you know, the word the, like, you know, so you're looking for something in one section and it's not there. I try to do what most people in most situations would do. And so, you know, it may not be the correct way according to somebody else, but for me, I try to do what actually matters. And that's what's in the field when you're out actually, you know, trying to collect these games. And so, that's how I did my list. And that's how I sort of, I did it the way that it would be useful to me. And the thing about all my lists is that, you know, I've used them myself. So I know that they work and I know that, you know, in the field, they're going to work as well.
In the few moments we have remaining, Sid, do you have any appearances or introducing anything new that you think listeners would want to know more about?
Well, I mean, I'm always, you know, showing up at different things and different events and whatnot. There's a show coming up in Hamilton and called Con Bravo. It's in Hamilton, Ontario. It's going to be in the middle of July. Conbravo.com is the website for more information. But I would suggest people just, you know, visit the Personal Computer Museum website. It's pcmuseum.ca. There's always different things happening. The next big event we have is in October. It's October 25th, and it's Game Night. I've been doing those for, I think, over 11 years now. We have a couple hundred gamers come out and just actually get to experience the collection of video games that I've amassed over the years. And it's a curated gaming night, so I pick everything that we play, and it's a lot of fun to get everybody together because, you know, collecting is amazing and it's a wonderful hobby, but at the end of the day, if you can't enjoy it with other people, what does it matter, right?
Well,
so that's why game night's a lot of fun.
And that's so well said, and boy, I've really enjoyed visiting with you, Sid, and your website is Sid Bolton, and it's SYDBOLTON, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Well, I know we're going to want to have you back, Sid. Thanks for being with us on The Collector's Show.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Harold.
More to come right after this here on The Collector's Show. I want to thank Sid Bolton for making time to talk to us about his collection. And like I mentioned to him when we were off the air, I know we're going to want to have him back in a few weeks to talk about his computer museum. But what a nice guy. And I just thoroughly enjoyed talking with Sid. He's such a great expert in his field and so engaging. I hope you enjoyed listening to my conversation with Sid too. Now, oh, and before I forget about it, as you might guess, I did go find Earthbound. You can buy it for $9.99 from Nintendo, and if I ever have a free minute, I'll probably buy it and play it, and I'll let you know how it goes. It was really a fun game, I guess from, I guess, the mid-90s. I enjoyed it, and I appreciate Sid letting me know how to find it. Now, next week on The Collector Show, if things work out the way I hope they will, we'll have Robert Perlman. Robert is the owner of Space Collectibles, and I want to talk to Robert about his collection of space memorabilia, things that have actually gone into space, and other things that are featured on his Collect Space website. And I also want to chat with him about the 45th anniversary of the first landing on the moon. That'll be next week on The Collector Show. In the meantime, stay in touch with all things collectible by going to my website, collectorshow.net. Thanks for tuning in. Come back next week. We'll talk about collecting space stuff here on The Collector Show. See you then. Bye for now.